The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Coming to you from Carter Subaru Studio. Welcome. Welcome to our top stories of this hour, and I'll get some newsier stuff at the bottom of the hour, but I'm going to begin with some 50-year-old news, because it was on Thanksgiving Eve, on November 24th. We're not quite hooked up with Felix yet. Okay, we'll hold off. I screwed up because Felix was hooked up with the radio station, and then I called to talk to him, and I realized that my call knocked him off the station connection. So now we're resetting that right now. But we will get him because it was 50 years ago tonight when D.B. Cooper became a man of legend because they never found his body. He requested parachutes and a couple hundred thousand dollars in cash. But that also, even though it's the same date, and it was Thanksgiving Eve, and our resident historian, Felix Spinell, who does a great job with every single thing he touches. I thought it was really cool that he put together a D.B. Cooper special for this evening here on Cairo Radio. Hello, Felix.
Hey, Dory. I mean, you know, if there's one thing I love more than local history, it's local media.
Yeah.
You know, and I, like you, I'm a little bit younger than you, but I have so many great memories of wall-to-wall coverage of big news events. Like, I think the big one for me is the Mount St. Helens back in 1980.
Sure. Yep.
But this was a similar event back in 1971, which I heard you talking about yesterday. I mean, this was when the news broke about almost exactly 50 years ago when that plane was hijacked in the late afternoon out of Portland. It became international news, but it was, number one, it was a local story because it was a plane headed from Portland to Seattle.
Well, and like I was saying, and I'll repeat myself a little bit, I was kind of peripherally aware of the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. I was 7 years old. But the first news story that just captivated me was this one. And I remember where I was, Felix. I was eating on, we had TV trays. My mom would always let me eat in the living room with the TV as my babysitter.
Like the sign of American civilization right there.
Exactly. And then the special report. I even think we were watching King 5 at the time. And it was during a newscast. What time of the evening was it when it first broke?
Well,
do you remember?
Yeah, it took off from Portland around 3 o'clock, and I think word got to the ground that there was a hijacking underway sometime between 4 and 5 p.m., so it might have been the 5 o'clock news or right around the 5 o'clock news on that day exactly 50 years ago, which is crazy.
Yeah, and also being a Thanksgiving Eve, but yeah, the people from our church had stopped by for a visit, and then we were just riveted. So we have a lot of people who didn't grow up here and maybe are only barely aware of what happened that night. So take it away.
Yeah, I mean, well, like you, I've grown up obsessed with this. The big thing for me was when they found some of his money in 1980. And we're actually going to have the kid who found the money live with us on my show tonight at 6 o'clock.
Nice.
But I also, it's crazy. I arranged an interview with Special Agent Larry Carr of the FBI. He is the last FBI agent who really had a deep focus on this case probably a decade ago. And I asked him to just kind of start things up by kind of giving me the background basics of how the case unfolded.
On November 24th, 1971, a man entered the Portland airport. He bought a one-way ticket, I believe it was $20, to Seattle. It's a 30-minute flight. Later that afternoon, he boarded the flight, took a seat in row 18, I believe it was seat E, ordered a bourbon and 7-Up, smoked some Raleigh filter tip cigarettes, and just as the plane was starting to roll down the runway for takeoff, he turned around and there was a stewardess sitting in the jump seat by the rear exit door, and he handed the stewardess a note that said, you know, he was hijacking the flight. And interestingly enough, her name was Florence Schaffner. She thought it was just him passing his phone number, hoping that, you know, she would call him for a date or something like that. So she just put it in her pocket. She didn't even bother reading it. And when Dan Cooper saw her do that, he said, "Miss, I think you should read that note."
Did he say, Felix, how far into the flight were they when he passed the note?
Oh, it's rolling down the runway. I mean, they just were getting underway because an ordinary flight from Seattle to Portland is only about 30 minutes, something like that. It's pretty fast.
Yeah.
So he had to kind of act quickly. And so it got underway almost immediately that he handed this note, which I love that she thought he was trying to pick her up. Right. I love the fact he's smoking, too. That's the best part.
You know what? I remember that. I remember because the back rows on the airplane were designated for smoking. Like that
blue,
was any
all, yeah,
kind
the
of
blue
a barrier
in the sky.
For everybody else. Oh, that was miserable. Couple
things he mentioned. He said Dan Cooper. That's the other thing. The guy gave his name as Dan Cooper. It was an error by a reporter and by the AP and UPI that spread the wrong name of the wrong alias of D.B. Cooper. And it just stuck. And that's what we call it today. But it really was Dan Cooper, which is kind of bizarre.
Okay. All right. So rolling down the runway. Then what happened?
And it's sort of this back and forth begins where another, they called them stewardesses in those days, Tina Mucklow goes back and forth taking notes between this passenger, D.B. Cooper, and the cockpit. They find out he wants $200,000 and four parachutes. And the policy in those days from Northwest Airlines with the FBI was just cooperate because he claimed he had a bomb. He had a briefcase, which he showed to Tina Mucklow at some point, which had sort of these red-colored cylinders in it and a battery and some wires, and she believed it was a bomb, and they took him at his word. The plane circled around for about 2 hours over Seattle and Everett while the FBI scurried around to get $200,000 in 20s. You know, in $200,000 in 1971, that's like $1.4 million now.
Sure.
So this was a serious chunk of money, and they were able to get it all together. They got four parachutes, a couple from the Issaquah Sports Skydiving Center, a couple other places, kind of gathered this stuff all together. And the plane landed sometime around 5:45, and it kind of taxied off to the southwest corner of SeaTac, kind of a dark part of the runway off away from the terminal and everything. And there's this really famous photograph of the plane. It's the only photograph I know of the actual hijacking in progress. It was taken by a guy named Bruce McKim from the Seattle Times. I tracked him down a few weeks ago, and he told me about how he got to take that photograph.
I got a call from the desk saying, get out to the airport. Something's going on. We don't know what it is. I got there around, 5:30 or 6, set up my 4x5 on a tripod and just hung out. And it was dark. And the airplane's parked over by the west side of the runway, shot a few frames, and then just stood by. And the picture that was used was while they were waiting for the ransom and the parachutes to come back.
Yeah. And it's the only known image of the thing actually in progress. And so, you know, it was a different era. The information was traveling by telephone. The law enforcement had two-way radios, but there was, of course, none of this internet stuff. And nobody really knew what was going other than that something was going down out at SeaTac. So the plane did, when he got the parachutes and the money, he let all the passengers go. And he said he wanted to fly to Mexico. They figured out that if they're going to fly to Mexico, they need to stop somewhere for fuel. Especially because he said he wanted the wheels down and he wanted the rear stair lowered too. And the rear stair is a feature that's specific to the 727. It's a Boeing jetliner you don't really see very much anymore, if at all. And in the very back of the plane, there's a staircase that lowers down and you can walk down the back. And the people in Portland actually boarded by way of that staircase because there was construction in Portland. So
and is it believed that he chose that flight and that particular plane for that very reason?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no other way you could really get out of an airplane the way he did on that back stair of the 727.
Right.
So he gets the parachutes. He gets the money. The passengers are set free. Tina Mucklow, one flight attendant, stays with him. And the crew, there's three crew members on the 727. They take off around, I think it was around 7:45, something like that. They're secretly followed by a couple of jet fighters. But it's one of these crazy dark and stormy nights. And you can't really, they're not able to really see what's going on. And the plane flies south. They're headed toward Reno, but they're down something called, I think, Victor 23, which is the kind of regular path between from here down to Northern California. And somewhere along the way, they think in Southwest Washington, based on they saw a red light come on showing that he had figured out how to lower the rear stair because he'd had that stewardess show him how to do that. Then he'd sent her up to the cockpit. So he's by himself back there. He ties all the money. Like, they'd give him the money in a bank bag, just a regular Seafirst vault bag.
And he had a big dollar sign on the outside of it.
Yeah, exactly. And it weighed something more than 20 pounds because it's like 10,000 $20 bills. So of the four parachutes, he asked for four parachutes because they thought he might try and make someone jump with him. He thought that if they tried to sabotage one of the parachutes, that they wouldn't do that if they thought, a poor innocent flight attendant or a pilot was going to have to jump too. So one of the last things that Tina Mucklow, that flight attendant, saw was Cooper kind of taking apart one of the four parachutes to steal some rope out of it to essentially lash this bank bag to his belt. Jeez. So it's not necessarily a great way to secure a 20-pound load as you're jumping out of a plane going about 200 miles an hour into like 7-degree weather, 10,000 feet above the earth in the darkness. One of the things that Larry Carr said, the FBI agent, he talked about these sort of choices in parachutes that D.B. Cooper didn't specify. And that sort of indicated that he was sort of more, just knew enough just to be a danger to himself. This is Larry Carr talking more about the parachute choice.
For his main chute, he chose an NB-6 bailout rig. So it's a Navy backpack 6. It's used for pilots ejecting from an airplane. It has no steerability. It has a high rate of descent. And it has an instant opening. So there's no sleeve inside on the parachute to delay the opening. So there was a lot of shock that would have gone through that, especially at 200 miles an hour. But he also had his choice of a sport chute of the day that was steerable, had a sleeve to soften the opening, and it had a much slower rate of descent. But he chose the worst parachute for the job he was facing.
I like hearing Larry laugh about that.
Oh, yeah. One other thing, too, Felix, because I thought I remembered this, but I just pulled up the numbers to prove it. Hijackings were shockingly common back then.
Yeah, they were.
And I just pulled up hijackings by year, and that year, 71, there were eight, which is a lot by today's standards. But then right after D.B. Cooper, 72, 22. 87, 83. It was like after D.B. Cooper, it became almost routine when planes would occasionally get hijacked.
Yeah, and not too long after D.B. Cooper, they actually instituted the kinds of airport security measures that were really beefed up after 9/11. Because when Cooper got on the plane in Portland 50 years ago, he bought a ticket under an assumed name. He didn't go through any kind of a metal detector or x-ray. They didn't get patted down. He just walked onto the plane because we hadn't evolved to the point where we thought we needed to protect airline passengers from other passengers with these kinds of intentions. And a lot of hijackings back then were political. Like, people wanted to fly to Cuba, or they were trying to hijack with a gun. A bomb is, I mean, this is crazy. A bomb is preferred by they thought that he chose a bomb because it's so indirect. It's just like, you can't wrestle it out of his hands without endangering everybody's life if he really had a bomb.
Sure.
Some people think it was just road flares that he had, like road flares and a battery and wires made to look like a bomb.
Yeah.
And they never found the briefcase, never found any of that. They did find this money. We're going to talk to this kid. I mean, say he's a kid. He was 8 years old, this kid, Brian Ingram. He's now, I guess he's either 48 or 49, because this was in 1980. And he found about $6,000 of the money along the Columbia River in a thing that kind of made them rethink the entire search that had happened in 1971. Because, daylight the next day, they're searching out in the area of where they thought he had jumped based on where they thought the plane was and based on the wind and everything. And that was mainly the Lewis River Valley. If you're driving I-5 south, it's around the Woodland exit. If you got off there and went about 10 miles east, there's a place called Ariel, and there's Lake Merwin. They thought maybe he'd fallen into Lake Merwin, or he'd tried to jump there because their lights were visible from the dam. There's one thing. We could do a 10-hour show on all the theories. My show tonight is really focused on the facts.
Yeah.
It's a little easier to organize that way. But when this money turned up on the Columbia down near Vancouver, it was upriver from where the Lewis River entered the Columbia, which meant that Cooper or the money and or both of them landed much farther east, maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 miles east of where they thought, in a totally different river valley. So they searched in the wrong place, essentially, when they did the search in 1971. So the money was probably in the Washougal Valley. And that was a big deal. That was kind of a revelation in 1980 when that money turned up along upriver from the Lewis River.
So what was the screw up in their original vectoring of where they thought it was versus where that money was found? Do they know?
What I've read is that the pilots have reported they were on this marked air course called Victor 23, but there was another pilot flying behind them in another airliner headed south who actually, before they found the money, had reported to the FBI, hey, I think the airliner was actually farther east of where they thought they were. It was just sort of a less digital time. There was less, less specificity or less accuracy in knowing where they were. Or maybe they're just so distracted they didn't know they were off course of where they thought they were. Plus, the wind was blowing a lot stronger than they imagined it was based on the readings at the airport, this other pilot told them. So okay. they either pushed the jet farther east, and it also pushed Cooper and the money together or separately or who knows what. But it is pretty amazing they never found anything. No parachute, no body, no briefcase, no, you know, pair of brown loafers that the guy was wearing. It's kind of strange because they really did search a lot initially, and all kinds of amateur people have searched for decades in this area and along the river. So
are there people who think he survived this?
I think there definitely are, because I think people want to believe that. I mean, this is, he's a criminal. It was a crime, but nobody got physically hurt, right? Northwest Airlines paid up $200,000. They had insurance. The flight attendants were traumatized, certainly, and the passengers really had no idea what was going on. I interviewed one of the passengers for my show, and this guy named Larry Feingold, and they just thought there was some kind of technical problem that they were burning off fuel for 2 hours flying around, or, you know, really they were stalling for time. They didn't really know. Larry Feingold didn't know till they landed, and he saw an FBI agent that he knew because Feingold worked for the U.S. Attorney's Office. So they managed it really well. I mean, things could have gone terribly wrong, I guess, if people on board had figured out Cooper was up to something, or if there'd been some kind of a scuffle or something. That'd be a whole different story, probably.
Yeah.
But it's got this kind of, it's not exactly Robin Hood, because I don't think D.B. Cooper was planning to distribute his wealth to the poor if he survived. He was doing it out of self-interest, but it's just all the ingredients for a really first-class mystery, specifically Northwest, because you couldn't do this in Iowa because there's nowhere to hide. You couldn't do it in Florida. I mean, it's sort of, there's something about the rugged terrain here and all the wacky people who've been attracted here for centuries that make this such a uniquely Northwest thing that I think it's clearly, I mean, this, I'm not the first person to say this, but it's like in the realm of Sasquatch and UFOs. And,
right, you know, it's mythical.
Stuff like that.
It has entered the realm of the mythical.
Absolutely.
Through all of this.
And it's,
go ahead.
I just say it's just cool that there's still people alive who were there witnessing this and who were on the plane and who had a firsthand, you know, contact with this. And that's been fun to talk to them for putting the show together.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's really cool that you're putting that together. So 6 to 7 o'clock this evening right here on Cairo Radio, which be not only 50 years to the day, but it'll be 50 years to the hour when this thing
happened. Isn't that great? Yeah. I did that on purpose. And I wanted to preempt that really high rated fourth hour of Tom and Curly.
Oh, they get to take the fourth hour off tonight, don't they?
Yeah, they're going home early.
How fortunate for them.
Happy holidays.
All right, well, everybody should listen in. Cairo Radio this evening, 6 to 7 o'clock. And everything you do, Felix, is just fascinating. And this is great. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me on. Have a great Thanksgiving, Dory.
Same to you. Happy Thanksgiving. Felix Minnell, our resident historian. And that is your big lead for today.
The Big Lead on Cairo Radio.
Okay, I got a little more news to get to, but one piece of news that might be the most disturbing of the day, the week, the month is Billboard, the music chart company. They have a new all-time number one song. And we got to kick this one around, too. So we got a lot more to do. Oh, and a special Thanksgiving message at the end of this half hour. So big stuff coming. Don't go anywhere. The Dory Monson Show rolls on. Nicole's off today. Chris Martin is in producing. And Chris, you sent me a news story this morning that I find to be just profoundly disturbing and chilling.
How so?
Because it's so wrong.
Were you really attached to the previous number one?
No. Just the fact that that was the previous and the new one is the current. So... You know, Chris knows I like music. Chris is an actual musician. So Billboard, which is the definitive, used to be magazine, but now website of the top 40 charts, they have a new number one song, Hot 100 song of all time. And should I just play it for the listeners, you think?
Sure.
Okay. Well, first of all, here's what it dethroned. This is the song that was the number one song of all time, according to Billboard. okay song. Does that sound anything like an all-time greatest song to you?
No. No. In my head, it seems extra stupid, but when I was pulling it, it sounded sort of raw and R&B-ish, so I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I like that aspect. But there's 10 better Little Richard songs than that song.
Yeah. Although that was Chubby Checker, right? The Twist.
Yeah.
Okay, so then they said it has now been knocked off the top spot by this song by The Weeknd. Am I seriously supposed to believe that that's the number one song of all time?
Well, the number one TV show was Big Bang Theory for a long time. So. I don't know if that helps you out, understanding it.
That's not any good.
No,
that song there.
It's the kind of song where you go into a bar to get a drink and you just look at who you're with and say, let's get out of here.
Yeah, it's the kind of song you hear if you're walking through a Vegas casino. It's Vegas casino music, but this number one song of all time, Blinding Lights. Shouldn't I have at least heard the number one song of all time, too? Shouldn't that be at least part of the criteria?
You've never heard that song?
I don't think so. Like I said, maybe in a casino.
I've heard all these just through osmosis, you know, just being out, you hear this stuff at shopping malls or bars or whatever.
Did you check to see what the criteria was?
Yeah, it says based on historical performance on the Billboard Top 100 since, what was it? It's like 50, since 58 or something.
Well, yeah, Chubby Checker must have been close to 58, I would think.
Yeah.
But, I mean, almost every one of these songs just stinks. Here's the number... Where is it? Three song of all time. Oh, here. Here's the number three song in the history of popular music. Fingernails down a blackboard.
Yeah, that one really bugs me.
Oh,
that's really obnoxious.
It's number three of all time.
That's Santana with Rob Thomas, by the way.
Right. And I actually kind of agree. Do we have number four or not?
Let's see. I didn't pull them all. Yeah. No, that's the only one I didn't pull.
Okay, the only one that I kind of agree with is
Mac the Knife?
I think Mac the Knife is a timeless song. And it's been, I mean, it's ubiquitous in pop culture, even, you know, 60 years later, and Bobby Darin was the epitome of cool. But then it just keeps getting horrible.
Here, you want me to play a little bit of Mac the Knife?
Oh, yeah, please. That's cool. It's coming.
Oh, the shark, babe, has such teeth, dear. And it shows them pearly white.
That's a cool song. Man.
Just a jackknife.
Yeah, but top 10 of all time?
No, not top 10. But I guarantee you, number 5 is not a top 10 of all time either.
I like that a lot, actually.
I like it okay, especially because I've seen Bruno Mars perform it live, and he is a dynamic live entertainer. And so that elevates it. And the song's not bad. Okay,
it sounds exactly like Prince and the Time.
Right.
To me. But I thought that was the best song on the list.
Well, here's number 6. I got to move this along. That's all I need.
There's a million songs like that.
Yeah, there really are. That was Leanne Rimes. Hey, what does LMFAO stand for? Never mind. So this song is number 7 of all time.
Shake That.
Good Lord. Say, listen to more. Or is that enough?
Oh, sorry. I had both my mic in. I was talking to Shane about turning it down just a bit. Yeah, let's hear a little more.
Okay. Shake That.
Scamtail.
Now, do you like it? No, nothing happens.
No.
I've barely heard that one.
Is anybody going to remember any of these songs? And maybe Uptown Funk. That Smooth is memorable, just the way It's a Small World is memorable. But nobody's going to remember these songs.
But it's not a critical list. It's, you know, the songs were on the top.
Just on the charts.
Are in the charts the longest.
Okay. I have a personal deep connection with this song. That one's my favorite on the top 10.
Why,
Chris? Because one year my basketball team got fourth in state, and it was the first trophy in school history, and one of the dads put together a video with that song as the music bed of our time at state. And it's so every time I hear that song, I'm just transported back to great, great feelings. So, okay. And this is the worst of them all. Number 9 song of all time.
When I dance, they call me Magarena. And the boys, they say que soy buena. They all want me. They can't have me.
It's awful. Awful. And then anything with Ed Sheeran is awful.
I'm in love with the shape of you.
Oh, I hate this song. I didn't know that was this song.
I know. I thought this song was Justin Timberlake whenever I would hear it.
Oh, this is... Ah! So there are the top 10 songs of all time, according to Billboard magazine. Not one Beatles song, nothing from The Who, nothing from the Eagles or Chicago. Just disturbing.
The Eagles are Chicago.
Yeah, shouldn't they be on there?
No.
What do you mean?
No, but the Beatles for sure. But one good thing is Billboard says the greatest of all time artists, the Beatles are still number one.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's undeniable. Okay. You don't think Beatles and or Eagles and Chicago should be represented?
No.
Wow.
They're big sellers. I mean,
oh, yeah.
We can talk about that. I mean, critically, they're not my favorites.
Okay. I just saw the Eagles a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I heard you say they were good. That would be fun to go see them.
Very good. Yeah. Okay, coming up next, a very special Thanksgiving wish this is also very important to me because of who's going to be delivering the Thanksgiving wish. That's coming up next here on the Dory Monson Show. The stretch we come. What a weekly show, what a show, what a week. And we will be here tomorrow and Friday. We've put together best of shows for you. We have some really cool stuff, too. So if you're working during the day and can't always listen, first of all, we got a podcast. You can always listen to that. Have you checked out MyNorthwest.com lately? The Dory Monson Show has a dramatically stepped-up presence on MyNorthwest.com, as we're turning around most of our show stories there as well. So I hope you're catching up with that. We appreciate that. So on Thanksgiving Eve, I was trying to think of my message to you, and I've got one. But I was also thinking about Awesome Audio, because it was about 2 months ago when my favorite stand-up comedian, Norm Macdonald, passed away. And this is one of those cases of, I knew I was a big fan. You know, we planned a Vegas trip around, you know, getting great seats to go see Norm Macdonald down there. I knew I was a big fan, but I didn't realize how much he meant to me as a fan until he was gone. And I've been really, I've spent so much time just listening to his old bits and knowing that there aren't going to be any new ones to come. And I miss him tremendously. He had the exact comedic tone that just resonated with me perfectly. So he once did on Thanksgiving Eve, he went on Dennis Miller's radio show and he did his list of what he's thankful for. So I thought maybe for the last time that I can do this. Here's Norm MacDonald's Thanksgiving list.
I got a list of things that I'm thankful for. Every year I make them on the day before Thanksgiving.
Right.
So I can make a little speech, you know?
Right.
And I like if you'll have me to read my list.
Yeah, I'm going to not even interrupt you. You take your time.
Well, firstly, I'm thankful for the fine ladies who live across this country and leave pies on their windowsills so an old chunk of coal like me might have a meal from time to time. I'm thankful for all of my five children, especially the one that I like. I'm thankful for the simple things in life, like bread. Although I've never tried it myself, I hear it's quite good. I'm very thankful for the brave man who pulled me from a burning building last April and unfortunately perished in the process. I'll never forget him, you know. I don't remember his name, but I think he had a mustache. Of course, I'm thankful for being able to do stand-up comedy for a living, you know. There's nothing more gratifying than to step on a stage before a quiet crowd and with my comedy slowly turn them into an unruly mob. I'm thankful for women, the greatest creatures on earth, because without women, Dennis, there would be no cookies. I'm glad that this year the police finally solved the baffling murder of Margot Hemingway. And finally, what I'm most thankful for, of course, is serious, you know, is friends. Yes, friends. Especially that one where Joey buys Chandler a duck. That's the one I like the best.
Norm, I don't even think we punctuate that. I think it is such a beautiful list that we appreciate you calling, and we are thankful for your continued patronage here, and you have a good time in Hawaii. Happy Thanksgiving, my friend.
Give my love to your family, buddy.
Oh, man. Man, he was funny. And then he and I had a lot in common, too. I tried to get him in the studio. And I thought the lure to that, because he was the best in-studio guest whenever, and he liked doing it because, you know, when you travel the road as a comedian, there's a lot of dead time. You know, you do about 90 minutes set on stage, and then the rest of the time you're just doing that, filling time. So he would love to, you know, go on radio and TV shows and promote his show. But he was a big backgammon gambler. Well, he gambled a lot. He had a fortune twice that he lost to gambling. I mean, he'd bet tens of thousands of dollars on a game, but I tried to get him in to play backgammon, and I thought, well, this will do it for sure. And I realized when I didn't get a response, that was right when he disappeared from public view, because Dennis Miller had a podcast, and I was sure that Norm MacDonald would be his last guest because he was his greatest guest. And then when Conan O'Brien wrapped up his career on TBS, I was sure that Norm MacDonald would be his last guest. And when he wasn't for either one of those guys, I knew that something serious had to be wrong. And you know, then we find out he'd been battling cancer for 8 or 9 years. So when we went and saw him in Vegas, he was battling cancer then. But he would often talk very seriously, too, about his faith, and he was a Christian who, you know, believed he was going to heaven. But, oh, man, Thanksgiving wishes from Norm. What could be better? All right, and I want to give you what I'm thankful for, and it is you, because this, I mean, it's been remarkable this last year. 26 years we've been doing this radio show, and our ratings are, by a significant margin, the highest they've ever been in 26 years, and that is because of you. So I get to keep doing the show I love because of you. And so when I say my Thanksgiving prayers tomorrow, you will be at our dinner table with us. All right, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. Enjoy the best ofs, and I'll see you live Monday, high noon. Hey,
thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.